Good morning, Mr. Wolf. Thank you for your patience with us as we're struggling a bit with this technology. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is September 3rd, 2020. We have two arguments set by Zoom.gov this afternoon before considering four non-orals. Marshall, will you call the first case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley. The Honorable Judge Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-0100, Chelsea Lynn Ness, and on behalf of minor children, and Hope Michelle Wolf.
Mr. Wolf, you have 15 minutes for your argument. Please introduce yourself at the beginning so that our audio record will know who you are. And also note that there is a time clock on the screen as well, so that'll help us all keep track of time with that whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I appreciate the welcome. It's good to be here. I am Jonathan D. Wolf. I am here representing Hope Michelle Wolf, the appellant. I'll note there's no relation. I'm Wolf, just like the animal. She's Wolf with an E. I always tell people that's the 15th most common name in Germany or something like that, which makes it a pretty common last name in this part of the world as well. So this case stems from an order for protection that was issued at the district court level against Ms. Wolf. Now, the allegations surround an argument that Ms. Wolf had with her significant other, Mr. Ness. Mr. Ness and Ms. Wolf have been together for years and years. She's more or less a stepchildren or a stepmother to the Ness children. And the respondent in this matter, Chelsea Lynn Ness, is the ex of Mr. Ness and the mother of his children. So Ms. Wolf and Mr. Ness got into an argument that's detailed in the brief. I don't know that I need to get into the weeds on what the argument was about, but the gist is there were allegations made of a threat as Ms. Ness perceived it that was made in regards to the two children who were present for the argument. Now, nobody claims that this threat was actually directed at the children. It was an errant statement that Ms. Wolf made during the course of this argument between adults, you know, not directed at the children. So that is the basis for the OFP. And basically the question I think we are here to answer today is whether the district court found facts that were not made findings that were not supported by the factual record at trial, and whether the OFP can stand under Minnesota statute section 518B.01 as a result. So I think it's important to recognize that there were three witnesses who testified at the hearing. There was Ms. Wolf herself, there was Mr. Ness, and there was a Brooke Tabbitt. Now, those were the only three adults who were present during this argument. The children did not testify.
Can I interrupt you with a question? It's Judge Larkin here, just because your time's limited. It appears to me that the district court's finding is based largely on the allegations that petitioner set forth in her petition for an OFP. And the district court, in fact, referenced the sworn affidavit saying that mother had heard this threat in response to the argument at the hearing that there's no evidence that this threat occurred. Do you agree that the district court relied on that statement in the affidavit?
I don't know that the district court made that clear, so I don't know if I do agree with that. I don't think the district court said where it found the statement to have been entered into the record.
Let me ask you this. Is it your position that the sworn contents of the affidavit offered in support of the order for protection were not evidence that the court could consider?
I don't think the court can base its decision on that without cross-examination of the declarant who was at the hearing.
Did your client ask to cross-examine the declarant?
Well, Well, she never offered direct testimony. I think for testimony to be considered in issuance of an OFP, I think that testimony has to be taken at the hearing, and you know the.
There's case law in which this court has affirmed OFPs when the decision was based on an affidavit as opposed to live testimony at the hearing. Do you have case law or any other precedent indicating that a district court can't rely on a sworn affidavit in support of an OFP?
Your Honor, I don't think it can when a hearing has been requested. When these OFPs are requested, the requester fills out
I understand. I was a district court judge, so I did lots of these. So then my question is, I don't recall anything in the case law or statute that really sets forth the rules that govern this hearing. I mean, we know the rules of evidence apply and whatnot, but I'm not aware of any law addressing whether a district court may or may not rely on a sworn affidavit at the contested hearing.
You're correct, Your Honor.
On hearsay,
you know, the procedure is not necessarily clear. I'm sorry, what was that, Your Honor?
I don't recall there being any objection at the hearing to the fact that the district court indicated that she was looking at or considering the affidavit, nor do I recall there being any request to have the petitioner put under oath and cross-examine regarding the contents of the affidavit.
And Your Honor, nor do I. I wasn't the counsel at the district court, but I do recall the counsel at the district court level objecting to their not being evidence in the record of this statement. I believe the threat was, quoting some crude language, "I'm going to beat you and your stupid kids," or something to that effect.
Right. That argument was made, and what concerns me is in response, the district court said, "Well, I have petitioner's sworn statement in her affidavit," which to me would have indicated the district court's going to rely on that. And yet there was no objection that the district court shouldn't consider that statement, or if the district court was going to consider the statement, the affiant should be put under oath and cross-examined.
Your Honor, I think you raise a good point, but forget for a second the procedural argument. Let's say that statement was in the affidavit and the district court did rely on it. Ms. Ness has acknowledged that she was not there. She was not present. There were three adults present. So what that testimony is based on...
wasn't she kind of present because she had her child called and she could hear what was going on? So she may not have physically seen what was going on, but she was able to hear what was going on.
And she made that allegation in, I believe it was in a closing. Again, that wasn't sworn. That wasn't cross-examined. And she did, you know, I think she could recognize from the perspective of a pro se litigant, you know, that there were some evidentiary issues here, and she did interject that. But there were three witnesses who were there who said that did not happen. Now, I realize that, you know, judges get to weigh credibility, but there still has to be facts in the record which establish a fact before a judge can make that finding. And I just don't think that they were there in this case. When you have three witnesses who were there, all testify, all subject to cross-examination, who said it didn't happen.
Ness gave contradictory testimony to what Ms. Ness heard on the phone. And then when asked about certain other things, he said he couldn't remember. And the third witness was the sister of Ms. Wolf. So you can see where the judge might weigh credibility as to those two, as well as to your client.
I can see that too. But even, you know, going a step further, let's say this was a credibility termination. Well, look at the definition of domestic abuse in the statute. So for there to be domestic abuse, which there has to have been for an OFP to have been properly issued, there had to have been physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, which no one is disputing there was not. Under the third subdivision, there are a series of criminal offenses which are not at issue. No one alleges that those were committed. So the one that this had to have been issued under is the second provision, the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. Now, I understand that children are never comfortable when adults, essentially their stepmother and their father, are fighting. That wasn't a pleasant situation for them. Ms. Wolf admitted she made a mistake in having this argument, and she's paid for that mistake. That shouldn't have happened in front of the children. But there is no evidence in the record that indicates that fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault was inflicted on either of these two children. Now, none of the threats, let's
go ahead. Mr. Wolf, if I may.
Yes.
So the one part of her affidavit, in her affidavit, and I know you think we shouldn't consider it, but if we did consider what was in that sworn affidavit, the one part that's not hearsay is she said she overheard while she was on the phone the comment, "I will beat you and your stupid explicit kids." Why, tell me why that statement to a 9-year-old would be the threshold of the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. And the other thing that concerned me in the transcripts, I think it was the dad that testified that I think it was the 9-year-old that he thought was crying when she was going to mom that evening.
Well, Your Honor, number one, I'll point out that that was not directed at the 9-year-old. That was directed at Mr. Ness. So I don't think there's any allegation. And even if you look at this, the wording of the statement itself, it is directed toward the adult. And should that have happened? No, of course not. But I think we have problems when we have an evidentiary standard that we have to meet in assuming, just because a statement was made, that infliction of fear of imminent physical harm actually happened. Now, I know you don't get the benefit of seeing these parties either, but Ms. Ness is a petite woman. Mr. Ness is a large man. And did the children actually think that Ms. Ness was going to beat them? I don't think so. And in forgetting what I think about it, what we have to do is look at whether that fear was imminent in the moment. And there's just no evidence in the record to say that it was. I think if we can jump from the fact of a statement being made to assuming that imminent fear was inflicted, was felt and experienced by these children, I think the evidentiary standard loses all meaning. There needs to be evidence in the record to meet this evidentiary standard. And I just do not think there is, simply by the fact of a statement being made, even if we assume it was made, which, you know, as I'm trying to point out, all the witnesses who actually testified at the hearing said it was not made. I also, you know, think it's worth pointing out what Ms. Wolf alleged was the basis for bringing this OFP, which is essentially, you know, Ms. Ness doesn't like Ms. Wolf. She doesn't like the father of her children's new.
Well, that's not the sense I got. The sense was that her kids are crying that they don't want to see their dad when he's with your client. And she's protecting her kids because they've witnessed violence and
Your Honor,
and have threats made at them.
And Your Honor, there's no doubt that they were upset in that moment, but I don't think that moment accurately portrays the relationship that the kids had with Ms. Wolf prior to this event or after it. Now she couldn't see them after the OFP was issued, of course, but they do not dislike her. The children are not afraid of her. She was living there for 4 years prior to this. She got kicked out of her home because of this. She is employed at the middle school. She works with children every day. Children are not afraid of her. And, you know, I know this is not in the record, so you can't really base a decision on this, but Ms. Ness was there on the first day of school trying to get Ms. Wolf violated on this OFP. And she took every precaution with her employer to make sure she would not be in violation. She has to be at the complete opposite end of the school building, and we're in COVID times now anyway, so there's a lot of remote distance learning going on. But I simply don't think it's factually accurate to assume that these children had any kind of bad relationship with Ms. Wolf prior to this or after. Other than that, the relationship has now been severed, which is a bad thing too, because she is, you know, she's still with Mr. Ness. And once the OFP expires, she's going to be back to being a part of these children's lives. And this is something that these parties just have to deal with and work through. And the OFP is certainly not helping that. Bringing it back to the statutory language though, I think if we can allow the district court to assume that infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, and I cited a lot of case law talking about that imminent standard in the brief, if we can assume that that standard was met without any direct evidence of it being met, without even circumstantial evidence of it being met, if we just assume the statement was made, therefore the children were in fear of not just hypothetical harm, not harm sometime in the future, imminent physical harm. I think the evidentiary standard for these OFPs loses all meaning. And I really don't think that Ms. Wolf should have been, you know, essentially kicked out of her home. Now we're approaching close to a year and had all these implications with her job and everything. She made a mistake. She admitted it. She's paid for it. She's just asking that this be reversed, given that the standard wasn't met. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolf. We'll take the matter under advisement, and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.